Blog Talk Radio.
From the far reaches of the known universe, we are proud to present Brother Harold Muhammad, soldier, scientist, scholar. Blog Talk Radio's finest. Not so mad. Science on Black Hole Radio. Black Hole Radio. Black Hole Radio.
Black Hole Radio. Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to tonight's edition of Not So Mad Science here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, and as always, coming to you live from the city of Detroit with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad. Just because Berry Gordy took Motown to L.A., does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. We have an interesting show for you tonight. But before we begin, we're going to try a little bit of Brooke Benton just to get things started off, if we can find Brooke. But it appears that Brooke has been removed, unfortunately, from the playlist. Bad weather being such as bad weather is, it's causing some technical issues here in the Detroit area with Wi-Fi signals and such. But we're going to persevere and move through. So, we're going to start off with a little George Benson while we get things queued up and in the proper perspective as we get into tonight's program. So here we go with a little bit of George Benson.
I try.
understand the reasons that we carry on this way. We're lost in a masquerade.
Just recently, the New Yorker magazine released an article from the Department of Public Health. Is marijuana as safe as we think? Malcolm Gladwell, on January 7th of this new year, 2019, penned an article that he released at 5 a.m. in the morning. It was that heavily pressing on him. And he wrote, a few years ago, the National Academy of Medicine convened a panel of 16 leading medical experts to analyze the scientific literature on cannabis. The report they prepared, which came out in January of 2017, run some 468 pages. It contained no bombshell surprises, which I think perhaps explains why it went largely unnoticed. It did, however, simply state over and over again that a drug North Americans have become enthusiastic about remains a mystery. For example, smoking pot is widely supposed to diminish the nausea associated with chemotherapy. Panel pointed out, and I quote, there are no, and I'm going to repeat again, there are no good quality randomized trials to investigate this option. Again, I'm going to quote them. We have evidence for marijuana as a treatment for pain, but very little is known about the efficacy, the dose, or the routes of administration, or the side effects of commonly used and commercially available cannabis products in the United States. Now, what makes that particular statement critical? And I'll repeat it so you can see what I'm talking about. The side effects of commonly used and commercially available cannabis products. One must beg the question, what do you mean commercially available? That means the pharmaceutical grade or pharmaceutical quality marijuana made available via prescriptions. Is that marijuana equal to or the same marijuana that was readily available in the streets of the United States throughout the 60s, the 70s, and the early part of the 80s? Marijuana that was coming up from South America or the southern states of the United States that was being grown organically. This question, because it has been proven via the research of many scientists that the marijuana that you find pharmaceutically available in these dispensaries scattered around predominantly black neighborhoods is a chemically infused marijuana, a chemically induced and a chemically grown marijuana. It is not the same organically grown product that was made available via street merchants in the 60s and the 70s. However, the caveats continue. Is marijuana good for epilepsy? There's insufficient evidence. Is it good for Tourette's syndrome? There's limited evidence. Is it good for ALS, Huntington's disease, and Parkinson's? For these conditions, there is insufficient evidence. Is it good for irritable bowel syndrome? Again, insufficient evidence. Dementia and glaucoma. There's no evidence, so thusly, probably not. Is it good for anxiety? Maybe. Depression? Probably not. But as you read through this 400-plus page document, there's 5 through 13, which the writer says is the heart of the report, which concerns marijuana's potential risks. The haze of uncertainty continues. Does the use of cannabis increase the likelihood of fatal car accidents? Definitively, yes. By how much? This is unclear. Does it affect motivation and cognition? Hard to say, but probably so. Does it affect your employment prospects? Probably so. Will it impair academic achievement? There is limited evidence to suggest that this is so. Conversation goes on for pages. We do, in this country, need proper studies, the panel concluded, on the health effects of cannabis on children and teenagers and pregnant women and breastfeeding mothers and older populations and heavy cannabis users. In other words, on everyone except the college student who smokes a joint once a month. Panel also called for investigation in the pharmacokinetic and the pharmacodynamic properties of cannabis, modes of delivery, different concentrations in various populations, including the dose-response relationship of cannabis and THC of other cannabinoids, meaning the chemically infused grades of marijuana, where THC is the effective natural ingredient that causes the highness. Figuring out the dose-response relationship of a new compound is something a pharmaceutical company does from the start of trials in human subjects as it prepares a new drug application for the FDA. Too little of a powerful drug means that it won't work. Too much means that it might do more harm than good. the amount of active ingredients in a pill and the metabolic path that the ingredient takes after it enters your body. These are things that drug makers will have painstakingly mapped out before the product comes on the market, with a tractor trailer full of supporting documentation. With marijuana, apparently, we're still waiting for this information. It's hard to study a substance that until very recently has been almost universally illegal. And the few studies we do have were done mostly in the 1980s and the 90s, when cannabis was not nearly as potent as it is now. Because of recent developments in plant breeding, growing techniques, and the typical concentrations of THC, the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana has gone from the low single digits to more than 20%. From a swig of a near beer to a shot of tequila. Are users smoking less to compensate for the drug's new potency, or simply getting more stoned more quickly? Is high potency cannabis more of a problem for a younger users or for older ones? For some drugs, the drug response curve is linear. Twice the dose creates twice the effect. For other drugs, it's non-linear. Twice the dose can increase the effect tenfold or hardly at all, which is true for cannabis. It also matters, of course, how cannabis is consumed. It can be smoked, vaped, eaten, or applied to the skin. How are absorption patterns affected? Last May, not long before Canada legalized the recreational use of marijuana, Bo Kilmer, a drug policy expert with the RAND Corporation, testified before the Canadian Parliament. He warned that the fastest growing segment of the legal market in Washington state was extracts for inhalation. And that means THC concentrations for those products was more than 65%. We know little about the health consequences, risks, and benefits of many of the cannabis products likely to be sold in non-medical markets. Nor do we know how higher potency products would affect the THC consumption. When it comes to cannabis, the best case scenario is that we will muddle through learning more about its true effect as we go along and adapting as needed, the way, say, the once extraordinarily lethal innovations of the automobile has been gradually tamed in the course of its history. Curious about the worst case scenario, Alex Berenson also wrote a short manifesto titled "Tell Your Children the Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence." Berenson begins his book with an account of a conversation he had with his wife, a psychiatrist who specializes in treating mentally ill criminals. They were discussing one of the many grim cases that crossed her desk, the unusual horror story. Somebody who'd cut up his grandmother or set fire to his apartment. Then his wife said something like, "Of course, He was high, been smoking pot, of course. I said, yeah, they all smoke. Well, other things too, right? Sometimes. But they all smoke. Barrison used to be an investigative reporter for the Times, where he covered, among other things, healthcare and the pharmaceutical industry. Then he left the paper to write a popular series of thrillers. At the time of his conversation with his wife, he had the typical layman's view of cannabis, which is that it is largely benign. His wife's remarks alarmed him, and he set out to educate himself. Berenson is constrained by the same problem the National Academy of Medicine faced, that when it comes to marijuana, we really don't know very much. But he has a reporter's tenacity, a novelist's imagination, and an outsider's knack for asking intemperate questions. The result is disturbing. The first of Berenson's questions concerns what has long been the most worrisome point about cannabis, its association with mental illness. Many people with serious psychiatric illness smoke lots of pot. The marijuana lobby typically responds to this fact by saying that pot smoking is a response to mental illness, not the cause of it. That people with psychiatric issues use marijuana to self-medicate. Really true. In some cases, heavy cannabis use does seem to cause mental illness. As the National Academy panel declared in one of its few unequivocal conclusions, quote, cannabis use is likely to increase the risk of developing schizophrenia and other psychoses. The higher the use, the greater the risk. Barrison thinks that we are far too sanguine about this link. He wonders how large the risk is and what might be behind it. In one of the most fascinating sections of Tell Your Children, he sits down with Eric Messamore, a psychiatrist who specializes in neuropharmacology and in the treatment of schizophrenia. Messamore reports that following the recent rise in marijuana use in the U.S., it has almost doubled in the past two decades, not necessarily as a result of legal reforms, he had begun to see a new kind of patient, older, and not from the marginalized communities that his patients usually come from. Now, bear in mind, family and friends, that the term marginalized is educated terminology, political correctness for Black and Latino, the poorer parts of the community. These are otherwise stable, middle class, older, white professionals. Barrison writes, and I quote, a surprising number of them seem to have used only cannabis and no other drugs before their psychological breaks. The disease they developed looked like schizophrenia. But had it developed earlier, and their prognosis seemed to be worse, their delusion and paranoia hardly responded to antipsychotics. Messamore theorizes that THC may interfere with the brain's anti-inflammatory mechanisms, resulting in a dangerous damage to nerve cells and blood vessels. Is this the reason, Berenson wonders, for the rising incidence of schizophrenia in the developed world, where cannabis use has also increased? In the northern parts of Finland, incidence of the disease has nearly doubled since 1993. In Denmark, cases have risen 25% since 2000. In the United States, hospital emergency rooms have seen a 50% increase in schizophrenia admissions since 2006. If you include cases where schizophrenia was a secondary diagnosis, annual admissions in the past decade have increased from 1.26 million to 2.1 million people. Berenson's second question derives from the first. The delusions and paranoia that often accompany psychoses can sometimes trigger violent behavior. If cannabis is implicated in the rise in psychoses, should we expect the increased use of marijuana to be accompanied by a rise in violent crime, as Berenson's wife suggested? Once again, there is no definitive answer. So Berenson has collected bits and pieces of evidence. For example, in a 2013 paper in the Journal of Interpersonal Violence, researchers looked at the results of a survey of more than 12,000 American high school students. The authors assumed that alcohol use among students would be a predictor of violent behavior, and that marijuana use would predict the opposite. Whereas, in fact, those who use only marijuana were three times more likely to be physically aggressive than abstainers were. And those who use only alcohol were 2.7 times more likely to be aggressive. Observational studies like these don't establish causation, but they do invite the sort of research that could. Berenson looks, too, at the early results from the state of Washington, which in 2014 became the first U.S. jurisdiction to legalize recreational marijuana usage. Between 2013 and 2017, the state's murder and aggravated assault rates rose 40%, twice the national homicide increase and four times the national aggravated assault increase. We don't know that an increase in cannabis use was responsible for that surge in violence. However, Berenson, though, finds it strange that at a time when Washington may have exposed its population to higher levels of what is largely and widely assumed to be a calming substance, its citizens began turning on one another with increased aggression. His third question is whether cannabis serves as a gateway drug. There are two possibilities. The first is that marijuana activates certain behavioral and neurological pathways that ease the onset of more serious addictions. The second possibility is that marijuana offers a safer alternative to other drugs. That is, you start smoking pot to deal with chronic pain, you may never graduate to opioids. Which is it? This is a very hard question to answer. We're only a decade or so into the widespread recreational use of high-potency marijuana. Maybe cannabis opens the door to other drugs, but only after prolonged use. Or maybe the low-potency marijuana of years past wasn't a gateway. But today's high-potency marijuana is. Methodologically, Berenson points out the issue is complicated, that the first wave of marijuana legalization took place on the West Coast, while the first serious wave of opioid addiction took place in the middle of the country. So, if all you do is eyeball the numbers, it looks as if opioid overdoses are lowest in cannabis states and highest in non-cannabis states. Not surprisingly, the data we have are messy, but Berenson, in his role as devil advocate, emphasizes the research that seems cannabis, or that sees cannabis, as opening the door to opioid use. For example, two studies of identical twins in the Netherlands and in Australia shows that in cases where one twin used cannabis before the age of 17 and the other didn't, the cannabis users were several times more likely to develop an addiction to opioids. Berenson also enlists a statistician at NYU to help him sort through the state-level overdose data. And what he finds is not encouraging. States where more people use cannabis tended to have more overdoses. The National Academy panel is more judicious, however. Its conclusion is that we simply don't know enough, because there haven't or hasn't been any systematic studies. But the panel's uncertainty is scarcely more reassuring than Berenson's alarmism. 72,000 Americans died in 2017 of drug overdoses. Should you embark on a pro-cannabis crusade without knowing whether it will add to or subtract from that number? Drug policy is always clearest at the fringes. Illegal opioids are at one end. They are dangerous. Manufacturers and distributors belong in prison, and users belong in drug treatment programs. The cannabis industry would have us believe that its product, like coffee, belongs at the other end of the continuum. Quote, Flow Canna partners with independent multi-generational farmers who cultivate under full sun substantially and in small batches. The promotional literatures for one California cannabis brand reads, using only organic methods, these stewards of the land have spent their lives balancing a unique and harmonious relationship between the farm and the genetics and the terroir. Cannabis is not coffee. It's somewhere in the middle. The experience of most users is relatively benign and predictable. The experience of a few at the margins is not. Products or behaviors that have that kind of muddled risk are confusing because it is very difficult for those in the benign middle to appreciate the experiences of those at the statistical tail. Low frequency risks also takes longer and are far harder to quantify. And the lessons of Tell Your Children and the National Academy reports. Aren't yet in a position to do so. For the moment, cannabis probably belongs in the category of substances that society permits but simultaneously discourages. Cigarettes are heavily taxed, and smoking is prohibited in most workplaces and public spaces. Alcohol can't be sold without a license and is kept out of the hands of children. Prescription drugs have rules about dosages, labels that describe their risk, and policies that govern their availability. The advice that seasoned potheads sometimes give new users: start low and go slow. It's probably good advice for a society as a whole, at least until we better understand what we are dealing with. Late last year, the commissioner of the FDA, Scott Gottlieb, announced a federal crackdown on e-cigarettes. Now, we discussed this last week about vaping and the dangers of vaping. What goes around comes around. There's a vicious circle developing here. Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and Dean, it follows a pattern, if you know what I mean. He had seen the data on soaring, rising usage among teenagers. And he said, and I quote, "It shocked my conscience." He announced that the FDA would ban many kinds of flavored e-cigarettes, which are especially popular with teens, and would restrict the retail outlets where e-cigarettes were available. In the dozen years since e-cigarettes were introduced into the marketplace, they have attracted an enormous amount of attention. There are scores of studies and papers on the subject in the medical and legal literature, grappling with the questions raised by the new technology. Thing is clearly popular among children. It is a gateway to traditional tobacco use. Some public health experts worry that we're grooming a younger generation for a lifetime of dangerous addiction. Yet other people see e-cigarettes as a much safer alternative for adult smokers looking to satisfy their nicotine addiction. The British perspective. Last year, a parliamentary committee recommended cutting taxes on e-cigarettes and allowing vaping in areas where it had previously been banned. Since e-cigarettes are as much as much as 95% less harmful than the regular cigarettes. So the committee argued, why not promote them? Gottlieb said that he was splitting the difference between the two positions, giving adults opportunities to transition to non-combustible products while upholding the FDA's solemn mandate to make nicotine products less accessible and less appealing to children. He was immediately criticized for this position. However, he was found to be correct. There is no safety in vaping as opposed to regular smoking. Somewhere we have completely lost all sense of the public health perspective, according to Michael Siegel, a public health researcher at Boston University. And he wrote this after the FDA made its announcement. He says, every argument that the FDA is making in justifying a ban on the sale of electronic cigarettes in convenience stores and gas stations applies even more strongly for real tobacco cigarettes. You know, the ones that kill hundreds of thousands of Americans each year? Something is terribly wrong with our sense of perspective when we take the e-cigarettes off the shelf but allow the old-fashioned ones to remain. Among members of the public health community, it is impossible to spend 5 minutes on the e-cigarette question without getting into an argument. And this is nicotine they are arguing about, a drug that has been exhaustively studied by generations of scientists. We don't worry that e-cigarettes increase the number of fatal car accidents, diminish motivation and cognition, or impair academic achievement. We don't look at that. We ignore these facts. The drugs, though, the gateway that we worry about with e-cigarettes are Marlboros, not opioids. There are no enormous scientific question marks over nicotine dosing and bioavailability. Yet we still proceed cautiously and carefully with nicotine because it is a powerful drug. And when powerful drugs are consumed by lots of people in new and untested ways, we have an obligation to try to figure out what will happen. A week after Gottlieb announced his crackdown on e-cigarettes on the grounds that they are too enticing to children, Siegel visited the first recreational marijuana facility in Massachusetts. Here is what he found on the menu. Each offering laced with large amounts of a drug, THC, that no one medically seems to know anything about. Strawberry-flavored chewy bits, large citrus gummy bears, delectable Belgian chocolate bars, associated fruit-flavored chews, assorted fruit-flavored cubes, raspberry-flavored confection, raspberry-flavored lozenges, chewy, cocoa caramel bit-sized treats, raspberry and watermelon-flavored lozenges, chocolate chip brownies. He concludes, this is public health. Whereas I conclude, heed the words of Dr. Wesley Muhammad, where he pointed out with confirmed research data and statistics that the chemically infused and produced marijuana of today causes aggression, and females and heightened effeminity in males, resulting in schizophrenia. For those of you who are familiar with the Watergate years, I will repeat. Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and Dean. It follows a pattern, if you know what I mean. Dear parents, for those of you that are listening in, grandparents, students, particularly you college students, you have friends who smoke. You have friends who vape. You have friends who drink. You have friends who snort. You have friends who mainline with needles and shoot up. If you love them, tell them. If you cannot help them, save your own sense and sensibility, because you cannot save them all. Spare yourself the heartache and the heartbreak as you watch them deteriorate into nothingness. Teen alone. As states began to legalize the use of marijuana recreationally in these states, the degree of unemployment began to rise conversely with the increase of recreational usage of marijuana. As recreational marijuana began to be used, the corresponding rise in unemployment matched it number for number, decimal for decimal. Mind yourself and beware. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network, as we transition to our next piece of scientific information here on the Black Hole Radio Network on Not So Mad Science. We're going to have a little bit of D-Train as we transition over. We'll be right back.
This is the DJ Skate, Goon Smash.
Welcome back. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. The moon is upside down on the other side of the world. And for many who are blessed with the ability to travel, it is literally freaking them out. On January 6th, Jacinta Bowler, writing for Science Alert, said the following. You step off the plane, having traveled across the world to the opposite hemisphere. The seasons are all backwards. And when you look up at the full moon, you realize it's not even the right way up. Only is this incredibly weird, mostly because how did we know, or how did we not realize this before? But this curious quirk of our round planet, for all you flat earthers out there, actually has surprising implications for researchers trying to investigate the night sky. The moon and the night sky is actually rotated 180 degrees compared to our northern hemispheral friends, according to Jake Clark, who's an astronomer from the University of Southern Queensland in Australia. In his explanation to Science Alert, he says, in the south, we see the moon's dark oceanic Procaccium Sea in the southeast corner compared to the northern observer who sees it from the northwest corner. But why does it look like this? Well, it's simple. Physically, we're actually upside down compared to someone standing in the opposite hemisphere. So the next time you're planning to travel to a country near the equator during a crescent moon, when the moon sets, it will look like a smiling face. But if you're on the opposite side of the world, it looks like an angry face. So it all depends on where you're located on the Earth. But generally, the constellations we see in the southern hemisphere are rotated again by 180 degrees compared to the northern hemisphere. In Australia, Orion's leg and belt is commonly known as the saucepan, as it looks like a big old cooking pot. So can you see that what on the other side of the world sees? John T. Horner, also at the University of Southern Queensland, suggests a great approach. Simply get upside down. John T. said, I'm from the UK originally. And while I know the night sky really well, I sometimes find flipping my vision over helps me see the bearings. It helps me get my bearings. You can do a headstand if you're good at that sort of thing. But an easier way is to lie on the ground facing north and lean your head back until you see the ground at the top of your vision. You'll likely see the sky like they do in the southern hemisphere. But this isn't perfect. The Southern Cross, or the Southern Crux, is visible practically all year long in the southern hemisphere. But the northern hemisphere is lucky to catch a glimpse of it at all. So what does this all mean for astronomers? Well, for Clark and Horner, not much. They look for exoplanets by measuring tiny changes in stars' colors or light intensity. These properties wouldn't change considerably, if at all, on where you observe them, since you're observing these effects tens, hundreds, or sometimes thousands of light years away. Stars you want to study can't be seen on your side of the world. It can get a little bit tricky. It makes astronomy hard if you're a northern hemispherical astronomer wanting to work on southern stars you'll never observe from home. There's a good reason why there are so many telescopes right across the world and even fewer in space. And I'll quote, "We astronomers have world-class telescopes spread all across the globe, Kea in Hawaii to Mount Kent in Queensland, trying to unlock the greatest mysteries no matter what hemisphere you're in." If all this is blowing your mind just a little bit, never forget, the water goes down the drain in the other direction on the other side of the world too. So where it twirls right to left here, there it flows left to right. So for the spooky ones among us who have traveled around the world and says things are upside down when they travel to the other side of the world, guess what? They are. Because you're flipped upside down, so you see things in reverse. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. So let's move right along. There's a scientist in India who dismisses the theories put out by Albert Einstein. On January 7th of this year, scientists in India have hit out at speakers at a major conference for making irrational claims that ancient Hindus invented stem cell research. Some academics at the annual Indian Science Congress dismissed the findings of Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein. Hindu mythology and religion-based theories have increasingly become part of the Indian Science Congress agenda. But experts said remarks at this year's summit were especially ludicrous. The 106th Indian Science Conference, which was inaugurated by Prime Minister Narendra Modi, which ran from January 3rd through January 7th of this year. The head of a southern Indian university cited an old Hindu text as proof that stem cell research was discovered in India thousands of years ago. G. Nagwashar Rao, the vice chancellor of Andhra University, also said a demon king from the Hindu religious epic, Ramayana, had 24 types of aircraft and a network of landing strips in modern-day Sri Lanka. Another scientist from a university in the southern state of Tamil Nadu told conference attendees that Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein were both wrong, and that gravitational waves should be renamed Narendra Modi waves. Dr. K.J. Krishnan, reportedly said that Isaac Newton failed to understand gravitational repulsive forces and Einstein's theories were misleading. Critics said that while ancient texts should be read and enjoyed, it was nonsense to suggest they represented science. Now, I'm going to stop right there for a quick moment. Pro-Western European scientists who disagree. I caution you and I heed you to read these things better and to remove your ego out the way and look at what is being said to you. For centuries, it has been said that there's nothing new under the sun, and that as modern technology today progresses, they are finding that there are technologies that predated the coming of today's science that they have yet been able to understand and duplicate. Get off your high horse. Get down back behind your desk. Get out your paper and pencil and reevaluate some of the ancient writings, because the answer is there. Don't get so smug to think that you're the top dog when you're just the new fellow on the block and you're looking at a science that you don't understand and a mathematics that you didn't know existed. That being said, the Indian Scientific Congress Association expressed serious concerns at the remarks. To quote, "We don't subscribe to their views and distance ourselves from their comments. This is unfortunate." Premendu P. Mathur, the General Secretary of the Indian Scientific Congress Association, told the AFP news agency, "There is a serious concern about such kind of utterances by responsible people." India has a mixed relationship with science. On the one hand, it has a rich tradition of outstanding scientists. The Higgs-Boson particle, for example, is named partly after an Indian physicist and Einstein's contemporary, Satyendra Nath Bose. Particle physicist Ashok Sen, meanwhile, is the recipient of the Fundamental Physics Prize, the world's most lucrative academic award. But it also has a long tradition of replacing science with mythology, leading to a fringe culture of pseudoscience. Many believe under Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP party, pseudoscience has moved from the fringe to the mainstream. Mr. Modi himself set the tone in 2014 with his outlandish claims that cosmetic surgery was practiced in India thousands of years ago. Many of the ministers in his cabinet followed suit with similar claims. India's top science summit also started inviting academics with Hindu nationalists learning or leanings who have made equally bizarre claims. Such claims usually hark back to an imagined glorious Hindu past to bolster religious nationalism. The BJP and its hardline allies have for a long time mixed mythology and religion to bolster their political Hinduism and nationalism. Adding science to the mix, says critics, will only help propagate quack science and erode scientific temper. Also, as economist Kashik Basu says, quote, for a nation to progress, it is important for people to spend time on science, mathematics, and literature instead of spending time showing that 5,000 years ago their ancestors did science, math, and literature. And this, Not So Mad Science, with your host, Brother Hara Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. So as I begin to gather my things together, and we start to close out this edition of Not So Mad Science, keep in mind, you can no longer accept the status quo. We must become students of our world. So, I want to share with you some words about fear. So, let's take a quick listen.
Distinguished future physicians, welcome to Stomp on Step 1, the only free video series that helps you study more efficiently by focusing on the highest yield material. I'm Brian McDaniel, and I will be your guide on this journey through schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders like schizoaffective, delusional disorder, and schizophreniform disorder. This is the second video in my playlist covering psychiatry. Psychosis is disorganized thoughts and a distorted perception of reality. Psychotic individuals will usually have a loss of function and a lack of insight, meaning they don't realize their perception of reality is distorted. There are a few different types of psychotic symptoms, which we will review individually. Hallucinations are hearing, seeing, feeling, tasting, or smelling something that isn't really there. This sensation has no external stimuli. Due to a lack of insight, these individuals think that what they perceive is real. Schizophrenia is usually associated with auditory hallucinations, where the individual hears voices. Tactile hallucinations, like the sensation of bugs crawling on their skin, is usually related to street drugs. Olfactory or smell hallucinations are more commonly seen in the aura before seizures. Delusions are strongly held beliefs that are not based on fact. Due to the lack of insight, trying to convince a psychotic person that their delusions are false is almost impossible, no matter how much evidence you present. Delusions of persecution are the most common type and involve paranoia. These individuals think others are out to get them and are trying to follow them, spy on them, poison them, steal from them, or otherwise harm them. Delusions of grandeur are when an individual believes they have special powers, talents, or intellect. They may think they are famous, have supernatural abilities, or have religious prominence. Other common themes in delusion are guilt, thought control, thought broadcasting, or the belief that others can hear your thoughts, and ideas of reference, belief that people on TV, radio, print media are talking about you. Disorganized speech or thought disorder is random, incoherent speech that may involve repeating phrases or words that sound similar. The patient likely is not aware that their speech makes no sense to others. This is sometimes referred to as word salad. Catatonia is motor hyperactivity with repetitive, purposeless motions or motor hypoactivity that leads to complete motor immobility and waxy flexibility, where you can move the patient into an odd position and they will stay in that position for hours. It can include a complete disconnect from reality. Here is an example of waxy flexibility. If you moved a catatonic person into this position, they would be able to stay there without moving for hours. A catatonic state should not be confused with cataplexy, which is a type of narcolepsy where people have motor immobility while remaining completely aware of their surroundings. In the previous video in the psychiatry section, we covered mood disorders. There, we briefly discussed mania with psychosis and depression with psychosis. The key difference between schizophrenia and a mood disorder with psychosis is that psychosis in mood disorders is mood congruent. This means that the psychosis is only present during mood episodes and that the psychosis is in line with their mood. So a manic individual may have delusions of grandeur and a depressed individual might have delusions of guilt. You can see here in the top right corner, I give schizophrenia a high yield rating of 3. The high yield rating is a scale from 0 to 10 that gives you an estimate of how important each topic is for the USMLE Step 1 Medical Board exam, based on a number of factors, including how often each topic appears on retired Step 1 questions. To learn more about the high yield rating, you can click this orange box here. Schizophrenia is a chronic, progressive psychiatric condition characterized by psychosis and an abnormal interpretation of reality. They have a difficult time functioning in society due to progressive loss of function. Symptoms are categorized into two groups, negative and positive symptoms. Positive symptoms are behaviors or sensations that are not normally present. These symptoms may be related to an excess of dopamine. Examples include hallucinations, delusions, catatonia, and disorganized speech or behavior. Negative symptoms are the absence of normal behavior. Examples include a lack of initiative, diminished speech, disheveled appearance, and flat affect. There used to be specific subtypes of schizophrenia based on what types of psychosis were predominant, but the difference between those types was low yield, and in the most recent version of the DSM, those subtypes have been removed. To make a diagnosis of schizophrenia, you need to rule out other potential causes of psychosis. Street drugs like cocaine or hallucinogens, as well as prescription medications like corticosteroids or anti-Parkinsonian drugs can cause psychosis. General medical conditions such as stroke, delirium, and dementia also need to be ruled out from the differential diagnosis. Thankfully, these intricacies are a bit beyond the scope of the USMLE Step 1 exam. If the question stem has a clear picture of psychosis, you can safely choose schizophrenia unless there's a big hint like recent use of cocaine. We will cover treatment for psychosis, like antipsychotics, in a later video in the section. The same group of symptoms are associated with different diagnoses based on their duration. According to the DSM, schizophrenia must have symptoms that persist for more than 6 months. If the symptoms are present for less than a month, you have a different diagnosis. Symptoms of schizophrenia for less than a month is referred to as brief psychotic disorder, and symptoms for 1 to 6 months is schizophreniform disorder. Schizoaffective disorder is a mood disorder in the presence of a psychotic disorder. It can be thought of as schizophrenia plus major depressive disorder or bipolar disorder. Differentiating between schizoaffective disorder and a mood disorder that has psychotic features can be challenging. Thankfully, this is a bit beyond the scope of the exam, but the key is what symptoms are predominant. In schizoaffective disorder, psychosis is the primary symptom, and changes in affect only occasionally occur during psychotic episodes. These individuals will not be depressed or manic in the absence of psychosis. Alternatively, a bipolar person will primarily have mood symptoms and will only occasionally have psychosis during a depressive or manic episode. They will not have psychotic symptoms when they are in a euthymic state or neutral mood. Delusional disorder is characterized by a delusion and the lack of other psychotic symptoms, meaning no hallucinations or thought disorders. These individuals do not have a loss of function and may appear normal most of the time. Unlike the delusions in schizophrenia, the delusions in delusional disorder are usually fixed and non-bizarre. So while the delusion is not based on reality, it is at least plausible. A bizarre delusion would be something like aliens abducted me, while a non-bizarre delusion would be something like my neighbor is trying to kill me, which could potentially occur in real life. The prefix schizo means split. This has unfortunately led to a lot of confusion in the media and general public. Many believe schizophrenia is a type of split personality disorder, also known as dissociative identity disorder, when the two disorders are not related. The split prefix actually refers to the gap between a schizophrenic person and reality. This prefix applies to many of the disorders within the schizophrenia spectrum and other psychotic disorders category, which is a new title added to the latest version of the DSM. Schizoid personality disorder, schizotypal personality disorder, schizophrenia, and schizoaffective disorder all have detachment from reality and or others. These disorders also share features like blunted affect. Individuals with a family history of schizophrenia are more likely to be schizoid, schizotypal, or schizoaffective. As a memory mnemonic, you can think of there being a continuum from schizoid to schizoaffective, where each successive step has most of the characteristics of the previous step plus additional symptoms. The way I remember this is that as the number of letters increases, so do the number of symptoms. Schizoid personality disorder is when a person is very introverted and voluntarily withdraws from social interactions. Schizotypal can be thought of as schizoid symptoms plus magical thinking and odd behavior. Schizophrenia can be thought of as schizotypal symptoms plus psychosis. And as we have already discussed, schizoaffective disorder is basically schizophrenia plus a mood disorder. Schizophreniform, unfortunately, does not fit into this mnemonic. We will cover schizoid and schizotypal in much more detail in a later video about personality disorders. That brings us to the end of this video. If you liked it and would like to make it easier to find other videos from Stomp on Step 1, you can click on this orange box here. Our next video in the series will cover anxiety disorders like OCD, PTSD, and generalized anxiety disorder. If you'd like to be taken directly to that video, you can click on this black box here.
And that brings us to the
distinguished future physicians, welcome to Stomp on
Not So Mad Science here on the Black Hole Radio Network. I pray that I have provided you all with some serious information who are dealing with family members, friends, and associates that are showing signs and symptoms of suffering from drug-induced schizophrenia, or and other organic means of getting this condition. Schizophrenia and its variant psychoses all present symptoms. Let's be mindful. Let's get our family members and friends the mental health services that they need so that they can live full, long, strong, productive lives. This is Not So Mad Science, and I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Don't do drugs. Allah willing, we'll see you again. We'll hear from one another once again next week. Closing out, as we always do, keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith.